Culture Cube brings you Mix, the Minneapolis Indie Expo. Mix features independent comics and Midwest cartoonists. Come to the Soap Factory Saturday, August 21st. Admission is free. Google Minneapolis Indie Expo for more details. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
For today's show, you don't hear that on the radio.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Hello, and welcome to Culture Cube. I'm your host, Sarah Bowden. For today's show, all of our stories center upon the theme, You Don't Hear That on the Radio. We start off the show with a gesture two fingers away from a thumbs up. You don't hear it on the radio, and you definitely don't see it on the radio. Cristetta Borini brings us this report on the history of the middle finger.
In America, we have a funny sensibility of what is and isn't offensive. For example, to say I b***ed last night does not have the same meaning as this b***ing rocks. B*** and b*** refer to b***ing and b***ing, but b*** are more common than b***ers. It really depends on context. Not that you really understood any of that. But there is one insult in America that we can express vividly on the air. It's the one-finger salute, flipping the bird, the flag flown proudly at every poor driver. It's the middle finger. It's concise and makes a strong point. And in the words of Dave from Flight of the Conchords,
it's your way of saying, hey, you better not disrespect me, man, even though I'm going to disrespect you.
But where did this gesticular expletive come from, and why do we use it? I talked to Professor Joel Weinsheimer of the English Department at the University of Minnesota to find out more about this gesture's history and symbolism.
The hand gesture is at least 2 millennia old. But the term flip the bird is probably no more than 50, 60 years old. The hand gesture itself, extending the middle finger, was used as a sexual insult because of its analogy to male sexual organs.
Other theories exist around the middle finger's sordid symbolism. One dates back to the Hundred Years' War between France and England, where the French would chop off a captured English archer's middle finger in order to stop him from firing a bow. Uncaptured English archers would wave their middle fingers at the French, shouting, "Pluck you!" in reference to the wood of the bow. More likely, though, is that the digit's usage as sexual became popular among the Romans, well known throughout history for their lewd behavior. But Professor Weinsheimer believes that it is through America's Christian history that the middle finger went from sexy to dirty.
For example, the fact that it was the Puritans who had such an enormous effect on the ethos of New England and sooner or later on the ethos of the whole country that enforced certain taboos about sexuality.
Deciding what is and is not offensive can be very subjective, as Professor Weinsheimer points out.
And anything can be meant as an insult. I suppose if you take something the other person said as insulting, it's because you thought they meant it to be insulting. You know, it could be anything, like raising your knee. Oh, you meant to insult me.
Other cultures use different words and symbols to mark the taboo and the profane. In India, for example,
if the palm is down, then you can bend your finger back and forth, and that means come here. But if the palm is up, it has a specific sexual significance. To shush an Arab is to be extremely insulting. To say, shh, be quiet, is something that you only do to animals.
And in some cultures, even the ones that speak English, the people do not find certain terms profane. Kyle McKelvey, an art student from Scotland, talks about the differences he's noticed between his home country and the U.S.
America doesn't like the C word. Doesn't like the C word at all. I've been called up on it a few times by people saying you can't say that in public. And I've yet to meet one person who's given me a good reason why not. Because they always say, well, people find that offensive. And I say, well, I find people chewing gum offensive. I find people who don't discipline their kids offensive. If they want to do that, that's up to them. I'm not going to stop them. Just like they've got no right stopping me by saying the C word. What does that mean? It's just a word. It could be any word. It just happens to be that word.
McKelvey also noted that American media portrays much more physical violence than what he sees in the United Kingdom. And in McKelvey's mind, that doesn't seem quite right.
And I think it's better for someone to swear than shoot someone. I mean, if you're carrying around a vocabulary that may offend someone, I would rather have that than someone carrying around a gun and shooting someone.
For Culture Q, I'm Christetta Borini.
While you can't actually taste through the radio, Joe Kroll's review of the local Asian fusion restaurant, Ginger Hop, will make your mouth water.
I recently visited one of the Twin Cities' newest restaurant gems, Ginger Hop, in the hopes of breaking my dinky town dining doldrums. What I found was not only thoroughly hip, it was surprisingly satisfying. Ginger Hop, located on the corner of Hennepin and Northeast 2nd Street, is the newest venture from owners Jake Polt, Charles Lodge, Katie Leach, and John Provenzano. Like its predecessor, Chiang Mai Thai, Ginger Hop offers up contemporary interpretations of classic Asian fare. Walking in the front door, however, Ginger Hop is clearly at home in the beer and punk rock-drenched Northeast neighborhood. Step up to the bar and order off one of the better craft brew selections in the city, or sit back and simply let the aggressive melodies drown your sorrows. Food at Ginger Hop is tasty and cheap enough to support even a modest college budget, with entree prices ranging from $9 to $15. For the appetizer course, I was a huge fan of the hop wings, classic bone-in chicken wings drenched in a spicy sweet sauce made from Summit EPA that will give you a bit of masochistic pleasure you never knew you liked. When it comes time for the entrees, those used to getting their pad thai at Noodles & Company are in for a huge surprise with Ginger Hop's rendition. Amidst a heaping portion of classic rice noodles, the salty, wholesome crunch of peanuts competes with the sweetly acidic tang of lime in a glorious fashion. A helping of mock duck tops off the plate nicely and will surely please both the vegetarian and meat-loving crowds. My favorite plate of the entire evening was the Penang curry. It comes with a generous portion of Berkshire pork that's been braised for at least 6 hours before being drenched in one of the subtlest, creamiest curry sauces you're likely to find. Each luscious bite is followed by the warm afterburn of a spicy red curry. In fact, it's so good that you'll end up ignoring your manners and ladling the sauce up plain. Restaurant goers are warned, however, against General Tso's chicken. This simple take on General Tso's chicken lacks the subtle genius that graces much of the rest of the menu, ending up on the Lian Chin side of brilliant. If, after the rest of the meal, you've still got room for dessert, Ginger Hop is the place to be. Ignore the oh-so-tempting New York-style cheesecake and try the Guinness chocolate cake. Covered in a rich cream cheese frosting, it's moist, delicious, and pairs perfectly with a dark beer like Hitachino's Ness Espresso Stout. You might not be able to move after so many luscious calories, but then you probably won't want to either. With 8 vegan and 14 gluten-free dishes on the menu, Ginger Hop has got something to suit any diet and any taste, and is surely a restaurant you'll want to visit again and again. I know I do. For Culture Q, this is Joe Kroll.
Everybody has one food that they just can't do. For me, it's pickled pig's feet. Eric Dulski finds out why some foods taste great without feeling great.
Salt and watermelon. Ketchup and mac and cheese. Bacon and maple syrup. There's something in the back of every risk-avoidant mind that says, that's kind of weird. And yet, to others, these bizarre and horrific combinations of food are perfectly normal. That's the trick to the thing called mouthfeel. One man's rotting garbage is another man's aged dumpster cheese. Mouthfeel is pretty much everything about a food that you can't taste. For instance, ice cream is great, but what makes it great isn't just the taste, but the iciness and the creaminess. Meanwhile, cottage cheese is kind of gross, but what makes it gross isn't the taste, but the baby brain-esque texture of curdled milk. So how did this come about? We have people who can handle cottage cheese and sushi and liver and onions, hopefully not all mixed, and others who can't. I'm still a Freudian when it comes to human development, so I called up an expert on the subject of my tastes.
Hey, Mom.
Yes, hi.
This is Eric.
Yes.
When I was a kid, what kind of stuff just totally grossed me out for no reason at all?
Stickers.
No, but I didn't eat stickers. Besides stickers.
I could tell this was going to be a long conversation.
You never did the peas, carrots, that type of thing. You weren't really fond of vegetables.
When did I start to like vegetables?
I think when they became unground. It's all about texture.
It's all about texture, apparently. I was a normal little kid who didn't like baby food. And to think, I thought I was special.
If we fed you in the proper amounts, and it was arranged neatly on your plate, you were fine with it.
Well,
I'm sorry, there's no drama in that.
There's got to be some drama somewhere.
No, you were a chunky little boy.
Okay, that's about enough of that.
So that's all I need from you. You'll probably be on the radio in the coming week.
Why, are you recording it?
Yep.
I got her good. And yet the mouthfeel of certain foods still gives me the heebie-jeebies to this day. Cottage cheese, asparagus, if they were combined, I can't imagine the consequences. And in reverse, I never met a Dorito I didn't like. So I had to talk with a real expert on food, sorry Mom, to get a sense of where this thing called mouthfeel might actually come from. Amy Shipshock is a chef and the department chair of patisserie and baking at Cordon Bleu College in Minneapolis.
You know, I think nowadays people go back to kind of their childhood favorites. I know from my husband, who is also a chef, he actually loves a box cake. Here he's married to a pastry chef, but he loves a box cake that's a Betty Crocker with, you know, like a Duncan Hines frosting, something that you remember, yellow cake with chocolate frosting.
So childhood favorites also have a part to play. Then I must concede there's just a visceral response that can't be reasoned or identified or quantified. Take this demonstration banana, for instance.
The process of making this banana was, I bought it maybe a week ago. It's been in the fridge since that time. Mm-hmm. And when you put it in the fridge, it gets almost completely brown. So I'll open it up.
Okay. Well, so this is always something that happens in our household. This is the ongoing argument with my husband and I. Like I said, both being chefs, we both have very specific ways on how bananas are supposed to be. It's killing me sitting there watching you eat it, too. But I have to have my bananas that are yellow with brown spots on them. My husband tends to like them more on the green side. Now, you took that banana, you put it in when it was more green, into the refrigerator. So basically, an oxidation process happens once it goes into the refrigerator. Everything kind of stops ripening on the outside because it doesn't have that, you know, natural light and heat and that type of thing that it's going to actually, that would ripen it out in your kitchen.
So now we're at Plato's cave, the what is versus the ideal, and the problems that come up when the two aren't the same.
I am definitely one that has definite thoughts on how food should taste in my mouth. Like, for instance, for me, sushi is one. Can't do it. That nori, there's something about it that just throws me off. So a banana like this, knowing that it's not supposed to be complete mush in your mouth, is going to get me.
Mouthfeel and food preference seem to be just two more things where everyone is unique and special in their own way. Some like their bananas green, some like their bananas yellow, and I like my bananas on a hot sandwich with peanut butter eaten obnoxiously for the purpose of radio. For Culture Q, I'm Eric Dolsky, and that was delicious.
Welcome back to Culture Q. I'm Sarah Bowden, and right now I'm joined in studio with reporter Josh Ellis. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Sarah. How's it going?
Good. So going off the theme of things you don't hear on the radio, Culture Q's staff has compiled a list of things we want to hear more of on the radio.
That's right. That's our top seven, things we want to hear more on the radio.
And number seven is we want to hear more voices from different socioeconomic backgrounds.
That's right. It's refreshing and it gives us a great slice of life.
And it gives us a more accurate picture of what's going on, too.
Absolutely.
So number six.
Number six, more killer, less filler, radio shows and programs that deliver.
Yeah, I like it when I tune in and I'm given what they say they're going to give me. For example, if I tune to a Radio K DJ shift, I like the fact that I'm going to hear lots of eclectic indie music. I'm not going to hear a top 40 set.
For sure. And if you tune into a talk radio station, hopefully you won't be hearing long musical breaks. You'll be hearing a lot of talk and analysis and interviewing, because that's what you expect when you tune into that radio station.
Number five.
Sense of wonder moments.
I love these moments. I hope that Culture Q delivers you these moments at least once in a while. But it's that moment where you go, oh my gosh, I never thought of it that way before.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to talk to people who will take a podcast of a radio station out on a run or on a bike ride, and they come back telling you some amazing fact or little-known idea that you'd never heard of before, and you have greater knowledge because of it. That's wonderful.
Number four is accents. We love hearing different accents.
One of the most enjoyable things of walking downtown or hopping on a bus is hearing people speak and trying to figure out where they come from. How much more fun is that to do it on the radio, where you could just spin the dial and you could get people from all over the world with backgrounds from all over the world.
And the cadence of their syntax and the way they use they form their vowels. It's just fun to listen to. It's almost like listening to music.
You don't think that the regional dialects here in Minnesota are diverse enough, Sarah?
I'm just saying I like a collection. Number three, high quality local coverage.
I think local coverage is something that people honestly cannot have too much of.
It's important.
For sure. You want to know what's going on in the world and at the national level too, but I think it's very important for people to tune in and hear the straight story on what's going on in their hometown or in their city.
And sometimes I feel that it's just too focused on the coast. Important things happen in other parts of the country, and important things happen right here in Minnesota. Coverage that treats those topics seriously, I really respect and appreciate.
I agree. So number two, more analysis. If you do tune into a station, I really love tuning in and hearing a story where I have felt like I really know what's going on. Or when people call in to a show to ask questions, I feel like I've learned something more than just the name of the caller.
Yeah, and I like analysis that makes me think about something in a different way.
For sure, for sure.
Number one, the art of storytelling.
Everybody loves a good story.
And it's like when you're listening to the radio, being a little kid and having your parents read you a book almost.
You can have a very dry collection of facts, figures, names, but I want to hear a story. I want to hear a whole tale of what's happening.
Exactly. Well, thanks for coming in, Josh. This has been fun.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was Culture Q's two cents on what we want to hear on the radio. But Culture Q also wants to know what you don't want to hear on the radio. Therefore, reporter Maddie Van Cleave hit the streets to figure it out.
Commercials.
Usually commercials.
Commercials?
Commercials. Commercials and any music that's too jarring.
Commercials and heavy metal.
And rap. Really bad rap.
Oh, man. A lot of things. Commercials.
Diamond commercials. I feel like I've sold way too many diamonds on diamond commercials. Shane's diamonds, I'm just kind of sick of it, to be honest. I don't know that I listen to the radio and then go, yeah, I really want to buy a diamond today.
When it's like an infomercial that I really don't care about, or if it's one of those sad puppy like shelter commercials that make you want to cry.
whatever prompts me to change the television or radio or anything like that would have to be terrible music being played. And these are people chosen by the music industry to be flashy and sell themselves out. I don't respect that. So if I hear anything that sounds a little too overproduced or just kind of a bubblegum flavor, I don't respect it at all.
Maybe just when I've been listening to a radio station too long, because I like to listen to different varieties of music.
If I like the music or not.
A song that sounds just like the last song.
Oh, I have no idea. I'm from Washington, D.C.
Any radio station.
Any radio.
Yep.
What makes me change it?
Yes.
Obnoxious, repetitive music.
Would you like to answer a question for Radio K's Question of the Week?
No, I want to know English.
Okay. Thank you.
At Radio K, we take music seriously. One thing you definitely won't hear on the radio, at least on this station, is conversation on the look of a top 40 group. So, for today's show, I bring you a report on one of the most iconic haircuts of the 20th century, popularized by arguably the most commercially successful band of the 20th century. When the Beatles crossed the pond in 1964, one thing that made them stand out right away was their hair. Way too long, effeminate looking. The mob cut became synonymous with these foreign rockers who made American women swoon.
It's funny, in my history of rock and roll class, the students are always talking about how clean cut the Beatles were and what good boys they were. And that's the impression that people have now with over 40 years of hindsight, but it was not perceived that way at all. I mean, their haircuts were considered to be outrageous.
Dr. Alex Lubit teaches music history at the University of Minnesota. According to Lubit, the Beatles' aesthetic was quite the scandal.
I think that a lot of men found it offensive and threatening, and they found the androgyny threatening, too.
Here's a clip from a 1965 Beatles press conference in Minneapolis. It's a little hard to hear, but one reporter asked the band how they can sleep with long hair.
How can you sleep at night with that long?
Well, when you're asleep, you don't notice.
True.
Oh, that's old. How do you sleep with your arms and your legs still attached? Just the same.
The Beatles adopted their mop cut from the German photographer Jürgen Vollmer, who befriended the band back when Pete Best was drumming instead of Ringo Starr. Paul McCartney writes in the foreword, Hamburg to Hollywood, a book which details Vollmer's life and work, that meeting the photographer was an important event in the lives of the Beatles, and quote, his sense of style and excellent photographic skills were to have a profound effect throughout our careers.
How are you used to sleeping with his shorts? I don't know. Maybe that's why we've been up every night for the last few years.
Yeah, maybe that's why we have parties.
We can't
sleep with his long hair.
McCartney and his bandmates were sporting high fashion, but at first, people just didn't get it. Long hair was for women, not men. Eventually, the mob cut was seen on every street corner in America. But it took a while for longer hair to catch on stateside. Here's former Radio K station manager Andy Marlowe recalling one college roommate and his hairdo.
This kid who was a freshman moved in with us and he had a Beatles haircut. Well, it was about 2 inches long. And we just gave him unmerciful crap about that haircut.
What was so bad about the haircut?
Well, just that it was this kind of shaggy haircut. Everybody else's haircut was, you know, on the sides, tapered down to nothing. And on the top, maybe an inch or inch and a half long. And his was 2 inches long all over.
Let me tell you how it will be. So while the Beatles revolutionized popular music, they've also improved the quality of life for men who just don't want to cut their hair. For Culture Q, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Should 5% appear too small? Be thankful I don't take.
Well, that's our show. Today you heard stories from Christetta Borini, Joe Kral, Eric Dulski, Josh Ellis, Maddie Van Cleve, and me, Sarah Bowden. Our producers are Brady Nias, Christetta Borini, Eric Dulski, and Zach McCormick. Sarah Lemenchek is the arts and culture coach at Radio K. Until next week, this is Culture Q.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Q brings you MIX, the Minneapolis Indie Expo. MIX features independent comics and Midwest cartoonists. Come to the Soap Factory Saturday, August 21st. Admission is free. Google Minneapolis Indie Expo for more details.